And we're back with our first post-game of Season 2. Martin, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm really glad to be back. I'm really glad to be, you know, diving right into these interviews, and I'm excited to get these out. And these are important voices, and we get to hear some of their stories. So,
yeah, man, it's going to be a fun season. I honestly haven't heard everything yet. It's in process, but so far, intriguing. There's lots to talk about here. For those who didn't catch it, this season is focused on scholars who are pretty late in their careers. And so in some ways, what we're dealing with overall is like this interesting question of where is missiology now? And we get this very ample historical perspective of like what happened and what all has changed and why. And it's just really interesting.
You know, Greg, one of the things that I'm looking forward to is getting to talk to some of these folks who have really been significant voices in the field. I mean, these are the authors of the text that we are responding to in so much of missiology today, you know, our generation. And so there is so much to appreciate. There's so much to be thankful for. And I feel like, you know, this whole appreciative approach to missiology and missiology podcasts, it just makes sense that we're kind of going back and looking at some of these voices that have shaped our conversation.
Yeah, these folks are titans. They set the table. Even if things are moving in a different direction on one point or another, and methodologically here and there, whatever the case may be, it's response, it's dialogue with these who led out. I mean, we, as the saying goes, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and it's a pretty cool view.
It is awesome. I wish they weren't all white.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's part of the problem, is that like they don't get, like, today we discredit a lot of them because they're white men that are over 6 foot.
Yeah.
Like, no joke. So many of them are. And it is, anyway, we don't have to talk about
it broke my heart that Rene Padilla passed before we could get the interview done. That was definitely on my wish list for this season.
What about Laman Sané? Oh my goodness.
It was horrible. Yeah, it's a problem, the whiteness thing. So that's going to be a feature of our conversation with the Crafts as well, perhaps to their surprise. But as you and I were talking, this came up, and we do have a point of reference here for connecting the Craftian missiological anthropology and all that entails with a more contemporary conversation about maybe anthropology as such and the way that it proceeds. So you noted, Martin, a thematic kind of idea that popped out to you. What was that?
Yeah, it was the idea of power and the way that this becomes a key theme in the interview. So they start out by talking about, you know, the way that missionaries are in power, right? You have these missionary organizations, and the mission churches are, you know, there's the issue of control and domination. And, you know, and so it shows up for them early on with regard to issues of, do we use drums or not, right? Do we allow kind of dancing? Is that okay? And for the Crafts, they notice this power at work, and were in some ways really pushed against, their mission organization at the time, and even later on their discipline, but we can get to that in a second. But there's this pushing back, like, hey, we need to be aware that we're in power here, and that because of that, you know, we're disempowering other people that we're working with. And then, of course, later on, though, the issue of what they called at one point spiritual power. And that becomes, you know, one of the themes that comes up a little bit later. But, you know, they're looking out at where they're looking at the discipline of missiology, and they're saying, well, do you notice that we're not addressing one of the big questions that people are asking? And it's the question of, well, what do I do about, you know, demons? What do I do about this sickness? And what do I do about, I feel like I need power and I don't have access to it. And, you know, these missionaries aren't teaching us And missionaries themselves are going like, what do I do about this? But this theme of power is really, that was one of the things that stood out to me as really interesting. And of course, he's writing a book now. What was the title of the book?
Missiology with Power.
Missiology with Power, yeah. And they did talk about this thing, this idea of a powerless Christianity. But that raises some questions. You know, what does that mean? What does a powerless Christianity mean? What does that look like? But anyway, that issue of power, really, that was a theme that stood out to me. And I think it's a theme that matters to a lot of people right now, because among those of us who are looking at our discipline and at the questions of missiology through the lens of a decolonial or post-colonial, perspective or, bias, we're often thinking about issues of power. We're thinking about whose voices are silenced, and how that silencing really impoverishes the community, right? How it impoverishes our discipline. And in the way that some voices have been heard more than others. But anyway, Greg, that was what stood out to me as a really important a theme in this interview.
So this is a perfect example of why I love chopping up these episodes, because I didn't see it, or I should say I didn't hear it until you pointed it out. And then I was like, oh yeah, obviously that's so interesting, the way that runs throughout the interview in multiple ways. I mean, it's a multidimensional sort of theme, and I love that. And it also helpfully connects our conversation to this irksome question about the practice of anthropology, its role in missiology, the value of Kraft's particular understanding of Christianity and culture, to borrow the title of his book. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. Can you tell us, from your perspective, what is the trouble with anthropology in a decolonial or post-colonial viewpoint?
I think part of it is you have anthropology that even historically as a discipline, it emerges in the midst of the colonialism, right? The Western colonial project. So at the same time that countries like Britain are going in and colonizing Africa, and we ourselves in the United States, we have our own colonial projects, and in the midst of early 19th century, at the height of colonialism in many ways, you have, and earlier than that, you have anthropologists that are going in and they're developing things like, ethnography methods. And so the big question becomes, and the big problem becomes for a lot of people, well, in the same way that countries are going in and seeking to dominate, it seems that there's a lot of anthropology that goes in and in some ways it leads to domination, right? If I can define who you are, if I can tell your story, then if I can parse you out and your people and your society, there's that sense of, well, actually, Willie James Jennings calls it displacement. I have the power now to tell you somebody else's story. Mm. And in the way that silences people. So that's the big problem, right? So that's post-colonial thinkers are thinking, and decolonial thinkers are thinking, is there a way that we can redeem anthropology, right? Is there a way, or should we just completely leave this behind as a part of the colonial project, right? It was all these, these white colonizers that are coming up with these ideas about culture. And by the way, this is significant for our culture and time right now in the, our political conversations that we're having surrounding race. Mm. Culture and race are ideas that evolve right at the same time, right? So the study of these, even the concepts themselves, they emerge right around the same time as part of the same conversation. So, you can see what the problem would be for a lot of folks, right? This is a discipline that is riddled with a really dirty history.
Yeah, and so past, and so. In a sense, you could say part of the problem is that anthropology as an approach to describing who a people group is sort of making the arrogant move of saying my way of describing you is what defines you, and it's the right way to go about describing people, right? And so there's even as it attempts to be perhaps self-critical and cautious and looking for emic perspectives and doing all that it can to appreciate the culture, it still thinks that it has a way to be the one who correctly does all of that and ultimately decides what's what where a culture is concerned. Yep.
But what you said, just to back up just a little bit, it is so key to point out that these anthropologists were self-critical, right? I mean, so many of them, yes, there were some that were going in and wanting ways to dominate, but I think that sometimes it's understated, right? That so many of these guys, they're guys like Charles Kraft, and you know, Mr. and Mrs. Kraft, Doctors Kraft, and one of the things that you had mentioned earlier, do you mind going ahead and what were you saying? You were saying that like it doesn't stand up.
Well, yeah, I just think it is. There's this interesting phenomenon of you know, generalization. We paint with this broad brush in order to make the critique, and it's a necessary critique, right? You want to say, anthropology is a problem because here's my simplified summary, because it is a tool for objectifying mm-hmm. people,
right? The reductionist
it's not relational in the right ways. Maybe from a theological perspective, you mentioned Jennings, you know, the relationality mm-hmm. is overcome by or displaced by the objectifying process of kind of analyzing, picking apart the culture as an object. And so like, that's a useful critique. I just don't know that critique, when you apply it to say the anthropology of Charles Kraft, I don't think it survives encounter with the man. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you apply that relational priority to this very same issue, and you say, okay, what do I hear when I sit down with and listen to Charles and Marguerite Kraft? Well, what I hear is people who are profoundly, profoundly yeah. humble yeah. and seriously searching in their reflections on their practice in the field as anthropologists and missionaries at the same time, I would say.
Yep.
They're seriously searching for ways to overcome their ethnocentrism, yep. to amplify the perspectives and inhabit the viewpoints of the people to whom they've been sent.
And they're using the tools at their disposal, right? Yeah, I mean, they're using the tools that they yeah. have at, you know, at their fingertips, and tools that they themselves are also helping develop. But I love what you're saying, because Charles Kraft he's a humble guy, and you sit down with him, and as intelligent, as brilliant as he is, and his wife as well, you know, these are not people though that are standing, like, these are not highbrow, you know, looking for domination in the midst of their conversations. That's not what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, and perhaps even more closely to the critique, you know, to sit down and say, but Dr. Kraft, aren't you ultimately just objectifying these people so you can analyze this culture from your perspective and define it definitively? Mm-hmm. I just think, wow, that falls flat on its face in this conversation. Yeah. It just doesn't seem to yeah. work.
And you had mentioned,
it's not that's not a legitimate critique, that anthropology can't be misused that way, that in broad terms, the whole field or the whole approach is saturated with colonial interests and perspective. All of that is true, but anthropologists are human beings. Right. And so you would need to actually be in a relationship with the person who is trying to take the tools at hand and do something with them. And maybe the critique
that you're making, I think it's important to point out that this is a critique that has been made by others within the field, right? So you were mentioning a book earlier, and I hadn't read this text, but who was the text that you were mentioning?
So Stanley Grin's and John Franke's book, Beyond Foundationalism, from back in 2001, already kind of went after craft as an example, particularly in Christianity and culture, and the idea of the transmission of the gospel cultural forms being in some way the containers of meaning, or meaning giving rise to cultural forms, or however you want to talk specifically about that in Craftian terms, that's basically just another version of the kernel husk thing, where fundamentalists believe they have access to this sort of pure kernel of the gospel. All you have to do is remove the cultural husk, transplant it into a different culture, and you get, you know, new forms arising from that meaning. And so in the conversation, the broader conversation in evangelical theology about contextualization and epistemological foundationalism and so on, Craft was sort of a target there as well. Did I get it right? Was that the book?
Exactly. Which is interesting, because I mean, that's one direction. That's one camp that is taking shots at Craft. And there's another camp, though, right, from the other end of the spectrum. They're looking at this and saying, you know, how can you say that you say things like you don't do theology without heresy, right? So that's Craft, right? So it you have Christianity and culture saying things like, that all revelation of God can and must be and is consistently translated into these sometimes even contradictory cultural principles, right? And in the midst of all these different society and this being all things to all people, it just sounds like relativism, and it feels like it to people like Carl Henry, right? Who was not happy with Charles Craft and his Christianity and culture.
And so the irony of being Charles Craft and in this position is that he is to the fundamentalists, he's a relativist.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And to the progressives, he's a fundamentalist.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
And so he occupies this middle position that makes everybody upset. Yeah. But from that position, I think he makes astonishingly interesting observations and articulates some things that, for my money, they've remained undervalued. In fact, I felt vindicated in this opinion, because for me, Christianity and Culture was a pivotal book. The idea of ethnohermeneutics is still working its way through my own thinking. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was a watershed in some sense.
So did Bevins, by the way.
Well, that's what I was going to say. No, I was at the School of Intercultural Studies lectures that were celebrating.
Was it 2016 or 2015 that we did the
Museum of Theology lectures? Was it 75 years?
Yeah, it was exactly.
Yeah, and so Stephen Bevins, the eminent missional theologian of the Catholic tradition, was there as a panelist, and somebody asked a question to the effect of, you know, what's been the most significant contribution of Fuller SIS to mission studies or something like, it was something like that.
Yeah.
And he has Charles Craft stand up in the audience and says, every evangelical publisher refused to publish Christianity and Culture. He came to Orbis Books, Orbis published it, and it's one of the most important books in missiology in the 20th century, and it remains that way.
And he talked about his own transformation, right? He's like, I myself have been like profoundly influenced by Craft. I love that. That was an important moment, I think, in the theology.
Yeah, and so I felt like my own thinking on this was in some way vindicated by Bevins, because I did have the sense that a lot of people kind of looked askance at it.
Yeah.
And for me, I'll say today, 2021, I think Christianity and Culture's arguments and its perspectives. I mean, nothing is perfect, but I think that it's maybe the most undervalued contribution in at least missional hermeneutics that I could think of. I think there's a lot there that needs more consideration.
Yeah, in some ways he was ahead of his time, and I think that's why, you know, I think that's why certain folks took shots at him. It's concerning for people that for evangelicals that Kraft is saying, you know, that he's defending this validity of these divergent interpretations in different cultural contexts, right, of what the gospel is and what God is doing in the midst of all of it. And and yet he's saying it in ways that are really nuanced. And I think that's part of what's missed, is that I think there's been this sense that you at Fuller, at least, that you had to choose, where did you go with Hebert or did you go with Kraft? And, one of those certainly won out among evangelicals. And, in many ways, I think Kraft has, because of that, been marginalized, within conversations that really needed his voice and continues to.
Yeah. 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 It's interesting. All the dynamics and undercurrents, that shape these conversations and even disciplines ultimately. So we're affirming, I suppose, that there's some real difficulty with an approach to missiological anthropology that maybe reaches too far back to methods and perspectives that tended to do some unfortunate objectifying.
And harmful, right? I mean, that's the postmodern is it was harmful to the status and position of these people, right? They had less of a voice politically, socioeconomically it affected them, right? They don't get to tell their own stories. So in very practical ways.
Thank you for stating that more firmly. I was hedging too much there with unfortunate. Harmful, bad, wrong kinds of perspectives on people and on cultures. But at the same time, there's this secondary question, which I think is raised through one of his wishes at the end of the interview, the wish that anthropology and communication theory would kind of experience a revival in missiology. And so maybe question 1.A is it the case that that anthropology has experienced a decline in missiology? And 1.B would be, what should be the situation in regard to that sort of field of study and its relationship to mission? What do you think?
That's a great question. And I think that Dr. Kraft is thinking about Fuller in particular, that hope, that wish that he mentions at the end. And I can say that as someone who just last year finished up my PhD in intercultural studies at Fuller Theological Seminary, that there was a concern and a desire to have more anthropologists. We have this wonderful man and scholar, Johnny Ramirez Johnson, and we have Dan Shaw, who's, you know, definitely in the, you know, the fall of his career in some ways, right? He's part of that.
The autumn, yes, the autumn of his
career. Thank you. The autumn, not the fall. Yes, thank you. My English is not so good. But you know what, though? It's English is a tool for colonial domination. So you know what? I'm going to own it. Eric Aslan. I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but he would be in the, I think it's Aslan.
Lion?
Eric, Aslan? I'm really sorry. If you're listening to this, Eric, I'm
that's
I'm
the dopest name I've heard in a while.
Super good name. It's spelled a little bit different. Name. It has a couple of extra A's in there, but But anyway, we have these guys there, but there is a desire for the students to be taking more anthropology. Students like myself, who never took a course that was actually anthropology, even though
meaning that didn't have
anthropology in the title or looked at the history of anthropology, right? I mean, that's kind of something that's dirty. We kind of like sweep that under the rug. Let's not look at the history. Greg, you were making a great point, which is that I did take an anthropology course. I took it with you.
Yeah, I was in there. They let me cross over from the School of Theology to take this course, Methods for Observing and Interpreting Culture, which is basically, I mean, it could be titled Ethnography. But I was in there with you, and as far as my understanding of anthropology goes, it couldn't be more anthropological. Ethnography is it's a methods course. As the title states, methods for observing and interpreting culture. This is how you do these things in a very, I would say, postmodern way, a post-colonial way. I mean, it's taught with what I would call significantly updated perspectives on observing and interpreting those two actions, you know, ensconced in the title of the course.
Yeah. And it is important also, I think, to point out that really this does get to some of those major discussions and conversations that we're having in, like, as I would say, within the secular world as well, right? Do we stick with anthropology, or are we moving on to culture studies? And so a lot of these departments are changing their name, right? We don't take anthropology courses. You're now taking a course in Latino studies, right? You're taking a course in Latinx Hispanic studies. And people are not referring to themselves as anthropologists. They would say, I'm a theorist of culture, or, you know, there's other terms that we use.
All right. So the cynic in me wants to say, like, that's a semantic game. And there's reasons for semantics. That's not dismissive, but renaming it in order to avoid connotations doesn't mean you're actually doing something different. Even, I mean, methodologically, there could be real carryover, and almost inevitably is, because, yeah, well, of course, you're going to draw on the extant literature and practices of the field. And so,
yeah.
So can you rebuke me? Should I be more, appreciative,
honestly,
of that sort of shift?
Oh, man, so a lot of this I'm saying without even like thinking through this ahead of time, but here's what I would say. I would say
that's the best way to do a podcast.
I guess so.
Because
I guess
it's permanent. It's recorded for the rest of history.
For posterity.
Say whatever's on your mind.
Exactly. Well, I think the problem for me is that it feels really unrelational to do that, especially if we're throwing names in there. But anyway, I would say the big difference has to do, and again, it's not that the anthropologists earlier weren't doing this, but in general, there is the shift is who's getting to tell the story, you know, and whose words are we using, and whose methods are we using? And so, you know, narrative research would be something that is, it's not that it was unheard of within early anthropology or even, you know, anthropology as a discipline later on in like the mid 20th century. It's just that nowadays that's kind of the starting point, right? Like, how do we get these people's voices heard? Like, we want people's stories to be heard. And it's not that we're going in and trying to like categorize, systematize a culture and understand, you know, these, right? Those are the reductionisms that people are so uncomfortable with. Like, people.
Right. Well, and it happens. I mean, you can create boxes and say, you know, here's the piece of the culture that fits in this box, and here's the piece that fits in that box. And and it's not like that's an absolute fantasy. That, of course, that can happen if you come up with a system of analysis and force that upon what you're observing,
right?
But that's also inevitable to some extent. We all function interpretively with categories, and those are the only things that we have at our disposal in order to make sense of the world. And so, it's, you know, in some ways formalizing that, making it explicit and theoretically robust is both a good thing because it gives you the opportunity to critique it, to put it into peer review and let the academy do what it does.
Yeah.
But it's also a bad thing in that it maybe overly reifies them when they're not necessarily the legitimate categories for analysis in the first place or something like that.
Yeah. So, or they're not their categories. It's our categories.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
But you know, here's the other big thing. So here's the other shift is, and honestly, this gets to some of our own methodology within this podcast, but there was this sense among anthropologists of previous generations that you could go in and, you know, not just objectively, but in a, you could observe in a way that didn't affect the things that you were observing, right? And I think that's part of there is a major shift nowadays where people are saying, not only are you affecting the things that you're observing, and not only is your recounting of it shaping the story and morphing the story, right? It becomes more of your story than it is of the people. Not only is that happening, nowadays you have people saying, people that we would previously have called anthropologists, but probably are not comfortable with that term anymore, that are saying things you know what? Not only do you affect it, but you should. And so you should be stepping into these contexts and doing your research ought to be action research. In other words, it ought to be helping people move toward being more just, more equitable, more democratic, more, you know, less oppressive, less domineering, you know? And so how does your research help move in that direction within, you know, these communities? And I think that sense that, you know, we obviously know that we're affecting. And in fact, not only do we know that and accept it and admit that right up front, but and not only are we naming all of our, right, as many of our biases as we can, but we're also stepping in and saying, like, we intentionally want to do that. Now, here's what's fascinating is that that is what the missionaries are doing. Right from the beginning, people like Charles Kraft are stepping in and saying,
"Yes,
like we know we're not objective, and we are trying to shift this." You know,
and when I learned about action research, I learned about this move not only from the recognition, but even to the valorization of effecting change in a context as a researcher, observer, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I had a profound sense of relief.
Yeah.
Because it seems like such a pretense to me that anyone would operate in any capacity, whether a missionary or an anthropologist or a tourist or whatever, without a value system.
Yes.
And so to make the observation that I'm aware my values might be the wrong ones, I'm aware that other people have different values, I'm aware that when we talk to each other, those might be in conflict and so on and so forth. To make all of those observations is not yet to answer the question of, but I mean, do you value your values? And and what does that mean for this interaction? What does that mean for this relationship? Yeah. And there's a deeper sense of honesty in my mind. I mean, and I mean that really as honesty, just being intellectually honest about the stakes of this interaction and what I really actually want out of it. And to say that I shouldn't want that, or that I'm going to act as though I don't actually have a set of values that are pushing me towards certain ends, I think is in some way deceptive.
Oh yeah.
So I'm just relieved.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I would say it's deceptive. And to go back to this word I've mentioned a couple of times, is reductionistic, right? I mean, are doing it. And what I like about Kraft is the way that he combines that honesty with humility. And it's, you know, and so he can say things like, you're never doing theology without heresy, right? As much as we try to systematize our theology and lay down formulas, there is nothing universal about this. You know, nothing for all time. And so part of the humility is I'm saying this right now, and I know that I could be quote unquote wrong, right? Or that I'm going to change, you know, that the Spirit is going to guide me in a different direction. The Spirit of God is going to, shift and re-accent the things that I'm saying. And I think one of the things I love about Charles Kraft is the way that his own career reflected that kind of willingness to pivot and shift.
Right.
You know, it's him going into Nigeria and his willingness to pivot and shift when he realized, like, you know what, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how, you know, what the gospel is here. Right. I mean, or you know, I have some sense of how am I supposed to communicate this? right? And so he's asking questions like, well, what do you think it means? Right? So, you know, what do you think it means? And, you know, you teach me. Great questions, great questions. It's not the whole story, but it's a great question. So not only in Nigeria does he make a really important shift, he also makes an important shift later on in his career with these power encounters, right? With the conversations surrounding, transformative healing prayers. And that was really unpopular. It continues.
Yeah, it was a bit of a bit of a shakeup.
It was so much of a shakeup that a lot of people have just discredited him because of his more recent writings. It's just, you know what? If you're going to talk about that stuff, like, we can't take you seriously anymore. And that in my, so as someone who's taken one of these courses that used to be referred to as power encounter courses, man, what a transformative course. What an important class that I took. And it was really, so it was called Healing Prayer. And I took it with one of Dr. Kraft's students and just one of his mentees. And man, I use these lessons that I learned all the time in my ministry. So I work as a pastor at the same time as a preacher, at the same time that I work as an academic and as a professor. And man, and actually, I should say, I do a lot of pastoring in the midst of my academia, right? I do a lot of pastoring in the midst of my teaching. But man, I am so thankful that someone taught me to do prayers with people and to do them in ways that assume that God is at work and active and present and in ways that are immediately, sometimes immediately healing, immediately shifting of, and sometimes not. And that's okay too. I mean, I use it all the time. It's something that I teach people that I mentor. I teach them the things that I learned. I have a whole deal of gratitude, a debt of gratitude that I owe Dr. Kraft, even in my own formation.
That's I love that story. I really appreciate your perspective on the significance of that, even in the context of advanced theological studies. And I think it bears noting, maybe we can connect these two things. I'll just say personally, I'm not sure what a powerless Christianity is. You know, I don't come from a tradition that
that's a good question.
that practices the kinds of things that I think that Dr. Kraft are referring to. That you would have, you know, studied. That's
yeah,
not
no,
my
and I didn't
background.
Learn that. I mean, you and I come from the same tradition, right? And we didn't learn that as part of our restoration movement.
But so because of that, I feel a little more confident saying that I don't think that leaves my tradition powerless.
Well, what would that say about God and God's agency if he actually powerless? Like, your Christianity.
Yeah,
powerless.
that's my thought. I mean, I think it's either Christianity or it's powerless, but it can't be both. So I don't know. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm coming from. But at the same time, I recognize that the Kraft's attentiveness to these dynamics, to the Holy Spirit, that's not actually the kind of 180 pivot that someone might think that it is. Mm-hmm. Because I think the fact is, the reason that as an anthropologist, as anthropologists in the plural, I should say, the reason that they're so out of the way, their selves are not in the center of what's going on there. Their identities and their assumptions don't have the power, so to speak, that they might in that encounter, is because for them there is actually a third party in this relationship. Mm-hmm. And there's a reality, there's a powerful reality that's part of the encounter between cultures. It's a tertium quid, but it's a it makes a huge difference for how the interaction actually unfolds in the end. And I have to say, I think that that's probably the most significant thing that missiology brings to anthropology. You know, you can think about it the other way around, where it's like anthropology is brought to missiology and it's a tool or it's a field of study or whatever that gets appropriated. But I think probably we need to recognize the fact that if God is real, if as Mrs. Dr. Kraft says, you know, that how does she put it? There is a spiritual realm, right? Yeah. If that's how you see the world as an anthropologist, as somebody who's engaging self-critically with other cultures, that's a different relationship. That's a different dynamic.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real strength that potentially, you know, power and counter questions aside and the details of all that aside, I think it's a real strength of the perspective that the crafts bring to this conversation.
Yeah. And I think that, I think you're right though, that, that there is, maybe you're not saying this as, you know, with such a sharp edge, but you know, there's,
I'll put words in my mouth. Go for it.
I'm going for it right now because that's what we do. As anthropologists. I would say the problem is not that Christianity, that they're addressing a Christianity that's powerless. I think that they're the real issue that they're aiming at. And again, this is something that we're going to have to read their book and we'll have to do another podcast at some point with Dr. Kraft once his book comes out. But you know, they're getting at a Christianity that's secular, right? That's the target, is a Christianity where that actually approaches things like a secular anthropologist, right? Let's approach these other cultures and let's approach even our own issues that we're facing in a way that, in a way where God is so seldomly the subject of an active verb.
Yeah.
Yeah. I deeply respect, Dr. Kraft. I'm thankful for his, I think it's a humility that permeates a lot of his, not just his shifts personally, but it permeates even his theories. You know, when he can say something like, you know, most heresies are cultural, they're really cultural adaptations that we should not fear, and that, you know, theological truths that we own must be perpetually recreated, like a dynamic equivalence translation of transculturation. I mean, when he's saying things like this, part of what he's doing is he's deconstructing his own, or at least he's offering the possibility that we need to deconstruct our own assumptions. And what an important, what a relational way of approaching mission. What a relational way of approaching people that are different than ourselves.
Here's the quote that I thought summarized the big idea of Charles Kraft and his contribution to missiology. This is from his own wife in the interview. She's sort of admiringly commenting on his ability to make arguments to defend their positions, but just the way that she put this, I thought, yep, that's it right there. And I think it probably applies to all kinds of aspects of his life and career. She said, he is able to faithfully and quietly show where we are coming from. And I loved that. That was what, hearing his voice, I never had him as a professor, had met him in person, and hearing his voice on the recording, I thought that was a wonderful summation of, I think, his approach to mission and anthropology and a very long career as a professor, faithfully and quietly showing where we are coming from.
I love that. I think for me, one of my all-time quotes This is not from the interview. This is from a previous interview that I'd had a chance to do with him. He said, I'm not an academic. Academics is what I do, not who I am. And in the way that that plays out and the way that he unpacked that is he said, look, you're going to get critiques all the time. Like someone's going to critique you. And he took shots from every angle, mm-hmm. from all sides. And yet he continues to be a joy-filled, healthy self-concept, you know, a disciple of Jesus with that's comfortable with the journey and comfortable with the learning process. And I'm fascinated by his career, and I hope that we continue to engage Dr. Kraft's works in the years going forward.
Absolutely. Okay, man, I think that's a wrap. So if you want to support us, please go to patreon.com/missiology. We need some love. Got to keep this thing rolling.
And by love, we need money. Just
that's correct.
Lots
yeah,
of money,
that was
please.
A translational issue there.
I'm just going to go ahead and translate. I'm an anthropologist. I'm going to really tell you what he means by love.
if you go to patreon.com/missiology and try to input love in any other form than money, you will face significant difficulties.
Actually, positive reviews are another form of love, right? We are definitely words of affirmation as well, uh-huh. right? So yeah. feel free yeah. to put links in your like, I don't know, Twitter us, tweet us, Facebook us.
Yes.
I mean, like, we would love to get our podcast, you know, a nice broad audience, partly because when we hear from you guys, we're enriched by those conversations. And so we appreciate them. We know that we ourselves are in the midst of this journey, and our post games are very much us sitting down and, you know, there is God's spirit at work in the midst of the dialogue. And so we're trying to create space for that.